from Louisiana to Oklahoma, Hawaii to New York, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, America has bid farewell to the 41st President of the United States, George H.W. Bush. John Gizzi of Newsmax joins us for a look back at the career and legacy of President Bush. Democrats are preparing to take power in the U.S. House of Representatives. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on their legislative agenda. Prohibition ended 85 years ago, but vestiges of antiquated liquor laws remain in some states. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Jared Dieterle of the R Street Institute. And like most of us, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA watched the funeral services for President George H.W. Bush. He offers his thoughts on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President George H.W. Bush has been laid to rest at his presidential library in Texas. And Americans from across the land have spent the last week remembering and paying tribute to the former chief executive. Here to share his thoughts on President Bush is John Gizzi. John is the White House correspondent for Newsmax and previously, for decades, wrote for the conservative publication Human Events. John, welcome back to American Radio Journal. John, you have been covering presidents in the Washington scene since 1979, starting at Human Events, now, of course, with Newsmax. And you've met and interviewed all the presidents. Tell us, first of all, do you recall the first time you met and talked with former President George H.W. Bush and what your impressions were of him at that time?
I actually met him before he was vice president or even a candidate for president. I was living in Texas in 1978, and I went to an event where I met George and Barbara Bush. That's when Barbara revealed to me that of all the positions her husband held, the one she most loved was that of U.S. envoy to China. And she, in fact, traveled around and spoke to groups and showed slides from pictures they'd taken during their time together in Beijing. And I talked to him briefly, telling him I was from Connecticut and how my parents voted for his father at least once when he was running for his two terms in the U.S. Senate. It was pleasant conversation. Both George and Barbara Bush were a perfect lady and gentleman, but you had a feeling he was not yet done with public life, and he was going to do something soon. And that, of course, was his bid for the presidency in 1980.
Talk a little bit, if you will, John, about that 1980 campaign. Of course, that was the year in which he lost Ronald Reagan, but all ended well as he became Ronald Reagan's running mate, and of course, the rest is history. But how was that campaign? And the two ended up together, but it wasn't always an easy path, was it?
No, it wasn't. And remember, Reagan had always been the hero of conservatives, the natural heir to Barry Goldwater, someone like George H.W. Bush from Connecticut, albeit then spending his adult years in Texas, was considered a moderate Republican or establishment Republican. Everything about him reeked of the Republican establishment. His education at Yale, his being the son of a Connecticut U.S. senator, his positions in government. He served two terms in the House, failed in two bids for the Senate, and had all other positions, from being U.N. ambassador to being director of the Central Intelligence Agency, through appointments by Republican presidents. Conservative activists trusted none of this. He fought against Reagan under the slogan, "A president you won't have to train," saying that his resume would make him someone superior to Jimmy Carter, the proverbial outsider, or Reagan. At first, it appeared as though he had a good chance. He won the main caucuses and forced out then-Senator Howard Baker, another potential rival for moderate votes. He beat Reagan in the Iowa caucuses, a stunning upset, and one in which led Governor Reagan to shake up his campaign team. Reagan won New Hampshire. As Bush said, he clobbered me. Bush went on to fight through the primaries as the only candidate left against Reagan. In the state of Michigan, he won 65% of the vote, in part because that was a state where previously challenged the favorite son, President Gerald Ford, and many Republicans didn't like it. It was also because he had a tremendous campaign run by a young and up-and-coming politician, State Representative Colleen House. Hmm. Bush thanked her for the campaign. And by the way, and by way of disclosure, she is today my wife.
I thought you would get that in there.
In the end, he went to the convention, made a good speech, and Reagan turned to him in much the same way Jack Kennedy turned to rival Lyndon Johnson.
And so George H.W. Bush became vice president, then he became president of the United States. And John, let's, in the little bit of time we have left, talk about how he was as president of the United States. Of course, by this time, he had become more conservative. He had served under Ronald Reagan. A lot of people viewed it as sort of a Reagan third term because George H.W. Bush had been part of all of that. Talk just for a minute or two about his term as president and what type of a leader he was for America. And using his phrase, it was a kinder, gentler time, very different from what we have today. So tell people a bit about the essence of what George H.W. Bush was like as a man, as president of the United States.
He was a perfect gentleman. Everything you are reading about and seeing on television, even people who disagreed with him, he spent time with. He put Jack Kemp, a former rival, in his cabinet, and he named Elizabeth Dole, wife of another rival, Senator Bob Dole, as Secretary of Labor. He embraced conservative positions, hence the view that his election was Reagan's third term. Over the last 8 years, his position on abortion had changed from personally opposed to strongly pro-life. Claire Booth Luce once said that you can sum up the accomplishments of any president in one sentence. I will sum that up and attempt to do so. He defeated the tyrant in the desert, and he began the building of a new Europe after the fall of communism. Those are pretty substantial accomplishments. The defeat of Saddam Hussein and rescuing Kuwait, and finally dealing with something no world leader anticipated, the fall of the Soviet Union. He oversaw a transformation without too much tumult into a democratic system in Europe. He also broke his pledge not to raise taxes in the U.S., which was near fatal for him. He embraced greater regulation, including the Americans with Disabilities Act and a much tougher Environmental Protection Agency. Coupled with a lot of factors, including rising inflation, he lost. He went on, as Jimmy Carter did, to become a beloved ex-president, doing much with his Thousand Points of Light Foundation, embracing old enemies such as Bill Clinton, and just becoming America's grandfather. I like to think of him most as a perfect gentleman, as something I strive to be and we all would like our children to be. He was America's first gentleman.
And I think today we can learn a lot from the manner in which he conducted himself and very, as you put it, a very gentlemanly approach. And we might be well put to move a little more toward that direction. We have again been talking with John Gizzi, who is the White House correspondent for Newsmax. John, where can folks go if they want to read your writings and also follow the news on Newsmax?
www.newsmax, and it will pop right up, or newsmax.com. And look for John Gizzi on politics. You'll see what I look like.
And I would advise everyone to follow John on Newsmax. Always insightful, always interesting. John, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth is keeping an eye on Congress because now that the campaigns are all over and Democrats are in a majority in the House, they have an agenda of their own. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Well, let's talk about what the new Democrat majority in the United States House of Representatives might do. They have a laundry list of things. Let's start out with an area where there may, in fact, be some bipartisan agreement, for better or worse, and that's the infrastructure bill. It's something the president has talked about. It's been on the back burner. Will that change?
Let me back up just a little bit. Once Congress convenes in early January, they're going to vote for Speaker. And right now, Pelosi is presumed to be the Speaker-elect, I guess is what you would call it. I strongly believe she currently does not have the votes for it right now, but I believe that ultimately she will. So once she is sworn into office, they immediately vote on a rules package, and that package basically dictates how the House will run for the next 2 years. There may be some things in there like earmarks are now permitted, so that's going to be something to watch. Republicans, there are a lot of them who want earmarks as well, but they're not going to put their hands on it. They're going to let the Democrats touch that issue first, and if it's radioactive, then they're going to say they're still with an earmark ban. But if they want to get their grubby hands on it, then they'll start accepting earmarks too. But after that, the Democrats are going to pivot, obviously, to attacking Trump on all sorts of things like the Mueller investigation, trying to get him to release his tax returns. But once you get past all of that theater, then you have to look at what the Democrats' actual legislative agenda is going to be. And the one that comes up the first, most likely, is an infrastructure bill. We haven't had a highway bill that was bipartisan and agreed to for quite a while. Trump made it one of his campaign promises. He said he wanted a $1 trillion investment in our country's infrastructure, and Democrats are certainly happy to spend more money. What will be interesting, though, is what the Democrat proposal is going to be compared to what the Senate Republican proposal is going to be, and then how do those two things mesh together to go to Trump's desk for a signature? The Democrats are already stating that they want a gas tax increase, I think as high as 25 cents. It's currently at 18. The gas tax is very regressive. It hits people in their pocketbook, and it hits low-income and middle-income people more than it does high-income people. I think that's a bad idea. Plus, with all of the innovations that are occurring with ride sharing and Uber and autonomous vehicles, I think we're going to see a dramatic shift in the way transportation occurs in this country. And the gas tax is a very unreliable way of doing that, of funding that. So I hope that conservatives and maybe Republicans at large will reject the gas tax increase that the Democrats are going to bring up.
That, of course, will be one of the major items that will be pushed. Now, another area of interest here, Andy, and it does play a role in the roller coaster ride that we've seen in the equity markets in the last couple of months, and that happens to be these free trade agreements, and specifically NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The president has signed a new agreement with Mexico and Canada, but that's not official yet, is it?
No, the way the process works is that the president notifies Congress that he's going to negotiate a new free trade deal, and he did that a long time ago. They then commenced the talks, and Trump made an agreement with Mexico first, and then he brought the Canadians to the table, and then they signed an agreement which basically said the three respective countries agree on a framework. The next step is that Trump submits that agreement to Congress, and Congress turns it into legislative text. They take what the agreement says, turn it into implementing language, and then they vote on it. And there is a very specific timetable for how that process works. Once Trump submits it to the House, then they have 45 days to consider it, and then it goes to the Senate. The Senate has, I believe, 45 days, and then it goes to Trump's desk. Now, with trade agreements, you cannot amend them. There's a limited amount of debate, and you cannot add amendments or strip language out. It's either an up or down vote. What's remarkably troubling about all of this is that Trump has publicly stated that he is terminating the original NAFTA agreement. There are a lot of people that don't think that the president can unilaterally do that, and you may see a bipartisan fight to restrict him from doing that. But what Trump is trying to do is force Congress to pass the new agreement, the NAFTA 2.0, because if he terminates NAFTA 1.0, they will have no choice but to pass NAFTA 2.0 or go back to the pre-NAFTA tariff rates from like 1991. And that would be a mistake with orders of magnitude. And it's one reason why the markets are getting roiled up right now. But Trump is playing this game of chicken, and I suspect that Congress could fight him on that. There are some Democrats like Sherrod Brown of Ohio who would love nothing more than to go back to the pre-NAFTA tariff rates. But in this day and age with globalization, that will absolutely harm America's future. So when it comes to trade, we're going to get into a very hot and heavy debate. The markets are going to remain volatile. The economy at large could remain volatile. So we're in for a rocky road.
And, of course, anything that comes out of the Democratic-controlled House will hit a Republican-controlled Senate, a Republican president. So it's certainly going to be interesting in the new year.
Yeah, it's definitely all theater. Nothing that the Democrats are going to propose in the House will likely become law, except perhaps an infrastructure bill.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, tell us a bit about the Club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Prohibition ended 85 years ago, but some states have yet to fully modernize their liquor laws. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jared Dieterall of the R Street Institute.
Well, raise a glass, folks. Yes, raise a glass to the end of Prohibition. It officially ended 85 years ago this week, all the way back in 1933. But as we will see today, the vestiges of Prohibition continue to linger on in some state policies, including where I have the unfortunate luck to live, and that is in the state of Virginia. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Jared Dieterall. He is the director of consumer freedom over at the R Street Institute. You can find their work at rstreet.org. And Jared is also sort of pulling double duty for us because he sat down with my Reason Magazine colleague, Peter Suderman, earlier this week for a special edition of the Reason podcast that covered many of the same things we're going to talk about today, but in more detail. They also talked about their favorite cocktails and their favorite booze. Lots of great stuff there. So if you like this conversation, go over to reason.com and you can check out a longer version of this. But Jared, we really appreciate you making time, not just for one interview with Reason this week, but actually two. Thanks for being here on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And Jared, before we get into the more substantial discussion, I just have to ask, how did you celebrate Repeal Day on Wednesday?
Well, I think like anyone that's a booze enthusiast, I had a drink. So I actually had a nice IPA. When I was talking with Peter, I recommended Boulevardier, nice pre-prohibition era cocktail. So yeah, I think you have to celebrate by drinking.
Yeah, I will drink to that. Definitely drink to that. And I had a really nice beer last night. I think it was a Bell's White Ale. Really, really nice winter beer that I enjoyed on Prohibition Day, or on Repeal Day last night. Jared, look, Prohibition's been gone for 85 years now. It's relegated to the dustbin of history. But you guys at R Street do a really great job of highlighting some of the ways in which Prohibition is still around. This sort of inclination to have government control the booze business is definitely something that is still with us, more so in some states than others. You've got a report out now looking at some of the dumbest drinking laws in America, as the report puts it. And a couple of the examples, maybe it's because I live in Virginia, but a couple of the examples here that really jump out to me are things in Virginia, a state where you have to go to different stores if you want to buy beer or wine or liquor. There's just sort of a bunch of things here that don't make a lot of sense. I don't know, to pick out your best examples here, but what is Virginia doing? How is Prohibition still living on here in the state of Virginia?
Yeah, well, I think probably starting in kind of the meta big picture would just be the Virginia ABC system itself, which is responsible for all these crazy outdated laws in Virginia. The Virginia ABC system, control state system, which means that right after Prohibition, Virginia decided, like several other states, many other states to control and basically be the entity, the government would be the entity that was responsible for wholesaling and retailing and selling alcohol to people. So what that means, you have to go to a government store that's run by the government, staffed by the government employees who are making government salary and pension, of course, to actually buy your booze products. And I think today there's still about 17 states that have some part of their operations government controlled for alcohol. Over a dozen still have government-run stores. So I think that if I had to pick one, I think it's the fact that I have to walk into a 1950s Soviet-like style store that's depressing and drab usually to actually be able to buy my booze products in Virginia.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, I can just say from personal experience, I live in Arlington, and literally right on the same block as my apartment building, there is both a beer store and an ABC store where you have to go to get hard liquor, and they could not be more different. The beer store, you go in, it's welcoming. The people who work there are really engaging. They want to talk to you about different flavor profiles and hops and malts, and they're really interested in it. And if you go into the ABC store, it's fluorescent lights. It's just like metal shelves. The employees there don't want to talk to you. If you ask them a question, they might mumble a response. They don't have any interest in what they're doing. It literally could not be any more different. We are talking with Jarrett Dieterol. He is the Director of Consumer Freedom over at the R Street Institute. And we're talking about the end of Prohibition, but also the way in which Prohibition is still with us in some small ways in state policies in particular. We were just talking about Virginia there, Jarrett. But as you said, this is something that in different ways, shape, and forms exists. These sorts of rules exist in lots of different states. The argument here, I imagine, the best argument for these types of things is along the lines of, look, alcohol is somewhat of a dangerous substance, right? I mean, it changes the way you think. It changes the way you act sometimes. It lowers your ability to control things. It makes it harder to drive, for example. Like, there are public safety concerns here. Do any of these rules make sense? Or like, how seriously do you buy the public safety argument for limiting the way alcohol is sold?
Sure, there's health and safety concerns with alcohol, but almost none of the laws that are on the books actually address those, right? So you can understand why there may be a law, whether you agree with it or not, but you can understand why there may be a law against over-serving, right? That makes sense. It's addressed to handle things like drunk driving. But it doesn't really make sense why you have a state control system, for example, that is requiring the government to be the one that sells alcoholic beverages to people, or why you might forbid a restaurant from advertising a happy hour special like Virginia does. Other states don't have those laws, and they don't have more elevated drunk driving instances. They don't have more problems with health and safety involving alcohol. So I think that, unfortunately, the evidence doesn't really justify a lot of these laws. So at some level, it's easy to say that alcohol should be treated a certain way because of its nature, but they're really the facts on the ground don't support any of the laws because they don't actually accomplish that. That's the ultimate problem.
And we saw this with Prohibition nearly a century ago. I mean, it's not as if cutting off alcohol or cutting off the legality of alcohol actually stops people from consuming it, and or in Virginia's case, whether you can advertise that a happy hour is happening inside a bar or not. I mean, those sorts of things don't actually improve public safety. They just don't make a lot of sense. That is Jarrett Dieterol from the R Street Institute. Unfortunately, we are all out of time for today, but Jarrett, thanks for taking some time and being here with us.
Yeah, thank you so much. Love talking booze. Appreciate it.
And again, that's Jarrett Dieterol from the R Street Institute. Check out their new report on the dumbest drinking laws in America. You can find that at rstreet.org. You can check out our coverage of Repeal Day and Prohibition and dumb alcohol laws as well over at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I am Eric Boehm. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The funeral of George H.W. Bush harkened back to a kinder, gentler time. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA discusses the contrast with today's lack of civility.
The passing of President George Herbert Walker Bush has catalyzed a national pause and reassessment, not only of who he was, but also of who we are as a nation and how different we are now than we were when he was our president. Several of the eulogies were genuinely eloquent. Some were merely nostalgic, but all of them were delivered within the context of today and thus provided unspoken contrast after contrast. Writing in Politico magazine under the title, "Most of the Bush's Funeral Wasn't About Trump," But of course it was. John F. Harris put it well. The memorial service for George H.W. Bush was a perfectly civil and eminently civilized event, and if one was listening in a literal-minded way, it all sounded like a grand exception to life in modern Washington. 2 hours of stories and tributes that were entirely bereft of political tension. The only way to listen in a literal frame of mind, of course, was through some equivalent of self-lobotomy, to be willfully oblivious of context, guileless in a way that certainly does not describe Bush or any of the people he chose to speak at his farewell. The service was replete with praise for the 41st president that could, with just the slightest nudge of interpretation, be heard as implied rebuke of the 45th president, but only implied, never explicit. This, unlike almost everything else in American politics today, was not about Donald Trump, and yet it very much was. Many of the speakers listed personal qualities of our 41st president that they thought were central to the character of that respected leader. Similarly, commentators in print, radio, and television delineated some of these traits. Here's a list of some of the adjectives that writers and opinionators served up in his honor. Decent, gracious, kind, courteous, civil, gentle, good, thoughtful, polite, honorable, polished, self-deprecating. The nouns were in the same vein: honesty, integrity, humility. So let's do a little wordplay experiment, putting John F. Harris's hypothesis to the test that the memorials for the 41st president also served as a rebuke of the 45th. The experiment is simple. I'll go through that list again, but I'll pause at each one and invite you to ask yourself this question. To what extent does each word of presidential description fit the current occupant of the White House? Decent. Gracious. Kind. Courteous. Civil. Gentle. Good. Thoughtful. Polite. Honorable. Polished. Self-deprecating. Honesty. Integrity. Humility. Not all are total misfits, but most are. When we elect presidents, we elect them for a combination of two sets of variables. The first set contains policies, ideas, initiatives, and philosophy. The second set contains elements of character, charm, personality, behaviors, and charisma. I voted for Donald Trump based on the first set. I am almost daily repulsed by how he exhibits the second set. The vast majority of his policies are quite similar to those of President George H.W. Bush, but his personal qualities are close to the opposite of President Bush's. This week has caused me to ask a question I now put to you. Can I do it again? This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WIBW AM and FM in Topeka, Kansas, WYHM FM in Rockwood, Tennessee, along with KORQ FM in Abilene, Texas. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.